Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. On today's show, how design reflects and influences national identity.
The Welsh Assembly didn't want a confrontational chamber as Westminster. Of course, the circle is the ultimate form. It gives equality to all.
We look at how to build a government building that works, how the meaning of national symbols can shift over time, and what goes into a high-flying flag design. Plus,
he has a knack of wearing what I'm sure are extremely expensive suits that look extremely cheap when he wears them.
Andrew Muller on how to judge politicians by their clothes. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. The design of government buildings matters. Inside and out, they need to reflect and cultivate the political values of a nation. Not many architects get the opportunity to build state legislatures, but I spoke to two who have. Hans-Jörg Göritz is a German architect who designed the Principality of Liechtenstein State Forum and Parliament in Vaduz. Ivan Harbour is a senior partner at Rogers, Sterk, Harbour and Partners, who built the Welsh National Assembly building in Cardiff. I began by asking Ivan about the particular challenges of designing a legislature building.
I think probably the most particular challenge was working with a client that was unused to building and building a building typology that, to be frank, probably we haven't built in the UK since the 19th century. So it was a voyage of discovery for a client, and we had to take them carefully through that process. And of course, because it's a political client, that gets embroiled in the public conscience as well. And what is normally a private matter between client and architect becomes something that's sort of commented on a regular basis from the outside world. I mean, it just increases the complexity of architecture, which is complex.
I wonder, Hans-Jörg, what were the particular symbolic challenges that were thrown up by the brief to design the Liechtenstein State Forum? Were you conscious of having to articulate through the building some kind of sense of national identity? And if so, how did you do that?
Yeah, I think that puts it pretty well. There was a high expectation of actually formulating an urban space, which didn't exist. It was not framed like that before. And the site was a pretty complex situation that held a couple of historic monuments like the government building, the state museum, and the state bank. Most of our competitors in the competition actually missed that opportunity. So we began in framing this design around the idea of making an agora within which all the physical representations of power and financial power and history were actually represented in that same space.
You designed the chamber within the Senedd. Did you have a particular idea of of political debate in mind when you designed it that you wanted to encourage? And if so, how did you do that?
We had a very loose brief, but one part of the brief that was clear was that the Welsh Assembly didn't want a confrontational chamber as Westminster. For our competition and submission, we simply drew a circle just as a point of debate. Once we started talking to them around the nature of how you created non-confrontational space, of course, the circle is the ultimate form. It gives equality to all. We even, to the extent where the presiding officer felt that he should sit at the same level on the floor with the chamber. The great debate, of course, then was to try and make it as flat as possible. So it was almost just a meeting room, and we had to balance that with the demands of television, of course, but we reached a reasonable compromise. But the circular form, it really gives them that sense that everyone is equal. What they didn't go for was my suggestion that in a technological world, they didn't even need to sit in their groups. In theory, they could sit next to their best friends, whatever party they represented. But hey, some things have to remain as they always have been.
Both of the buildings that you've designed try to articulate a sense of openness and transparency in their design as a way of reflecting that political value. But surely there must also be practical requirements to ensure a certain degree of physical security for the politicians in the building. Is that the case? And if so, how did you strike the balance between that?
Well, the government brief, again, the standard brief is all buildings must have small openings and net curtains to prevent bomb blast. So our starting point was clearly that is not transparent, literally or metaphorically. We worked with the specialists to, and it's part of the site planning to ensure that, in fact, the more open the building, actually, the more secure it felt, simply because there are eyes on the street. So we've moved from something which, you know, assumes a type of construction, a type of building form, to something which is very unconventional. So in the instance of this building, as we know, the public, the electorate, are above the elected, which is, of course, the right location. And you can contain the elected body. So the working environment actually is blind to the outside world from distance. And the issue is just who's walking above you. But they, of course, have already passed through security control to get into the building. Obviously, massively increased post 9/11, which happened halfway through our project.
Do you think that the design of a legislature can actually affect the political outcomes that take place within a country? And if so, do you feel a personal sense of responsibility for the politics of Liechtenstein now that you've designed the State Forum?
Absolutely. It became clear that the specificity in Liechtenstein is that these senators are senators on the side. They have their prime job to make a living outside of the parliament. And then when they gather, it's pretty much a working situation. So it's not that anybody does the work for them. It actually happens literally in the parliament itself, which was pretty unique for us to work with. And so we realized that from early on in the design process, that comfort and the spatial quality became a major feature, and the acoustic qualities, the spatial proportions, the lighting conditions, the technical equipment, the comfort that the systems in the building provide, all that together when they meet on a Thursday and work through the entire weekend and then part on Monday, was a major requirement for us in the design process. So in short, I think architecture really provides something very elementary to the quality of our work, and in that case, to the quality of the senators.
That was Hans-Jürg Guritz and Ivan Harber. In Jerusalem, there's a poster that's become a bestseller among visitors and tourists. Many of them don't realise that their souvenir is more than just a pretty modernist landscape. It actually began life as a tool to attract Jewish settlers to what was then British-mandated Palestine. Mary Pelletier dives into the sometimes controversial poster's unlikely history as a symbol of Zionist immigration and looks at how it's been reappropriated by contemporary Palestinians and designers.
Visit Palestine. It's a Jewish artist. He made this at the time of Palestine in 1936.
You see the color, it's nice color, and there are the mosque here, Dome of the Rock. It's in the middle, beautiful. This is something beautiful about Jerusalem.
There's many posters, but this is the most famous one.
These men are shopkeepers in the old city of Jerusalem, describing one of their most popular items, an early 20th century souvenir poster. It reads, "Visit Palestine," in big bold letters, just beneath a serene golden Jerusalem landscape. Some buy it for its vintage feel, and others as an expression of solidarity with the Palestinian cause. But many tourists, and even some old city sellers, would be surprised to learn that the poster was designed by a Jewish immigrant, for prospective Jewish immigrants, in 1936. Irith Hadar, the head curator of prints and drawings at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, explains.
Original poster of Franz Krauss is part of the collection of the Tel Aviv Museum of Art. And it was a commission for encouraging people to come and visit Palestine, which was then the name of this place. A bit orientalistic of the area of we are coming to build something new in this very old exotic land.
In 1995, Israeli artist David Tartakover reprinted the Visit Palestine poster. It was a symbol of hope at the time of the Oslo Peace Accords, and Tartakover was familiar with Franz Krauss's work, having curated an exhibition of his vintage posters at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art in 1981.
Reprinting it in 1995 again mixes times, because the Visit Palestine of 36 isn't understood like Visit Palestine of nowadays.
Like many Palestinians, 35-year-old Amer Shamali had witnessed the highs and lows of the Oslo Accords and the violence that followed during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. He was also familiar with the Visit Palestine poster, which had begun circulating around the West Bank. Shamali is a celebrated visual artist and Oscar nominee based in Ramallah, who often mixes stories of Palestinian heritage with a wry black humor in his work. The results are critical and witty examinations of the conflict across all forms of media.
2009, for me, it was the time to have the third edition of the poster. The first one was celebrating the State of Israel, the second one was celebrating the State of Palestine, and the third edition was a more realistic image of what's happening on the ground with the wall blocking Jerusalem, destroying the landscape, even disturbing the aesthetics of the poster, and declaring the failure of the two previous editions, the State of Israel, the State of Palestine, and the two-state solution in general.
Shamali used Krauss's original design as a basis for his own, mirroring the color palette and the bold text along the bottom. But the Palestinian landscape surrounding him in 2009 was less idyllic than the one rendered in 1936. Shamali added an element that would reflect the new realities of Palestinian life after the Second Intifada.
My intervention was adding the separation apartheid wall blocking Jerusalem. So you see a bit of Jerusalem on top of the wall, but it's a massive, ugly wall out of the scheme of colors and the poster, the soft colors. There's alien element blocking Jerusalem, disturbing the aesthetics of the poster color-wise and composition-wise.
And you've added a note as well on the bottom of the poster where kind of the original tourism message used to be, right? Yeah. And what does that say?
It says, I agree with you that adding the wall is vandalism and rude intervention. So, quote unquote. And basically, it's kind of playing on the words of, am I talking about the adding the wall on the poster itself, violating the copyright of the poster, and it's a rude intervention, or adding the wall in reality is a rude intervention and vandalism of the landscape and the situation in historical Palestine in general.
Shamali's third version of the poster was an instant hit, so much so that people began copying it from his website and printing it to sell to tourists in Bethlehem and Jerusalem, with no credit or money going back to Shamali himself. You can still find these copycat prints in various shops, but one man has helped to secure the fine art integrity of Shamali's design.
My name is George Al-Ama from Bethlehem. I'm 34 years old. I'm a researcher collector focusing on Palestinian art and Palestinian material culture. After seeing Amr's edition, which is the third one, with the wall added, I believed at that moment that this poster should be a limited edition one. That was my advice to him. And by doing that, it became also even more popular than the 1995 edition, because what the wall did to our lives as Palestinians, this poster became a witness or like a documentation for what happened with the wall.
You actually helped facilitate getting the limited edition prints into private and public collections?
In a way, yes. I think that the moment I have seen it and later meeting and knowing Amr made me help in the process of making it a limited edition silkscreen and to help in getting this poster into the best of collections. And finally, it is in the British Museum.
And there, the poster will stay. The latest link in the evolution of a design that significance has changed just as much as the landscape it set out to depict. For Monocle, in the old city of Jerusalem, I'm Mary Pelletier.
Regular readers of the magazine will be aware of the Style Leaders feature in its Affairs section. Each instalment puts the attire of a global political leader under the microscope, considering what her or his fashion choices say about their leadership style and political values. Andrew Muller is a frequent Style Leaders contributor. I sat down with him to find out how to judge a politician by their clothes. Andrew, thanks for joining me. For a group of people whose average sartorial standard is at best average, we pay an awful lot of attention to what politicians wear.
I thought you were about to start talking about journalists.
Why? Why do we? What are we as onlookers looking for when we analyse the dress of politicians?
Well, this is something that we end up doing once per issue in Monocle magazine, of course, in the Style Leader column, which I have written once or twice. That sometimes it's easier than others, because I think when we look at politicians, what we're looking for is exactly what they hope to project, which is authority, competence, likability, if at all possible. But they want to look like somebody in charge, not unreasonably. And I think we want them to look like they're somebody who should be in charge, also not unreasonably. The difficulties I find when you write the column and it is just a male leader of a first world Western democracy, that can be difficult, because basically everyone understands what the uniform is. You put on a smart suit, you do your tie-up, you polish your shoes, you comb your hair, and you're pretty much sorted out. The only exceptions to that, and they do exist, are people who are deliberately making a point of looking unkempt or ill-dressed or rumpled, but they think that communicates some sort of authenticity. We obviously have a couple of prime examples at large in this country, Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, and Jeremy Corbyn, the current leader of the opposition.
Of the Style Leaders that you've analysed, which have been the most interesting or at least remarkable?
The most interesting, or at least the most fun ones to do, are people who step outside the, you know, two-piece suit and tie and nicely polished brogues thing. They tend also to be the more interesting, in inverted commas, characters, the people who sort of cleave to traditional costume or whether they are just outright military rulers. And there aren't many of those who are left anymore. It really is only Thailand and Egypt who has a military dictator who pretends he isn't one. But I can remember doing one years ago on Colonel Gaddafi, which was quite fun to do, because obviously, though he was an absolutely dreadful man, he did have a fairly entertaining dress sense in one way or another, whether he was still rigged up in his kind of military uniform and chest full of self-awarded medals, or whether he was going for his sort of kind of ghetto fabulous take on the traditional Arabic robes. You would see Gaddafi coming away off.
You mentioned that, you know, the job's a bit easier for a male leader of a Western nation. There's somewhat of a uniform.
Yeah.
And looking at the nomination process for the US presidency going on at the moment, Hillary Clinton has just clinched the nomination for the Democratic Party. Donald Trump is the de facto nominee of the Republican Party. Now, it's interesting sartorially for a few reasons. One, Clinton's a woman.
Yep.
And they are analysed differently by the media and by ordinary individuals. And number two, we've got a man in the running, Donald Trump, who we care about the aesthetics of to a much greater degree than previous candidates, because he is aesthetically remarkable. Now, I wonder if you have any thoughts on what the way in which we've looked at those two reveals about, you know, what we think about politicians' aesthetics and dress in general and the gender differences in that.
You are right. Trump is unusual in that as well as in many other respects. I mean, the current incumbent, Barack Obama, I remember reading an interview with where he freely admitted that basically for every single day of his presidency, he has worn a variation of the same suit, the same shirt, the same tie and the same shoes, because as he says, in a given day in that job, you're going to end up making a lot of decisions. So he just figured that was one that would get taken care of. That was a few minutes every day. He didn't have to waste standing in front of his wardrobe wondering, what am I going to put on today? Donald Trump, you're quite right. He is an extraordinarily unusual looking man. He has a knack of wearing what I'm sure are extremely expensive suits that look extremely cheap when he wears them. He is an extremely strange colour. And he does, of course, have that absolutely extraordinary confection on top of his head. Now, I'm the wrong person to ask about how that would appeal to anybody, because I look at him like I think a great many. I think Trump is very much clearly one of those people, you either get it or you don't get it. And if you don't get it, if you cannot fathom why the grand old party has nominated this preposterous orange buffoon to be its nominee for president, I think it's very hard to understand how this plays. But clearly it does. But I think it does play for him. I'm assuming what works is that it's an expression of authenticity. You know, he may be a preposterous orange buffoon, but he's an authentic preposterous orange buffoon. He's not part of the in crowd. That at least is his shtick. He's the outsider. He's the common man. He doesn't look like a politician. He doesn't dress like a politician, and that works for him. Hillary Clinton, as you quite rightly point out, it's hard to know whether the fact of a female nominee for president or a female president of the United States is going to make it easier or harder for women to get on in politics without being judged on their appearance in a way that men clearly are not. It is, I have to say, I admire for this reason, if none other, women who actually aspire to a career in frontline politics, because the extraordinary extra burden of nonsense that you will have to endure and wade through that you wouldn't if you were male, on this score alone, to say nothing of all the others. And, you know, and some people do just naturally, are just blessed, both male and female, with a natural sense of style, and some are not. Julia Gillard, when she was Prime Minister of Australia, who is clearly one of the not endured sort of ridiculous catcalling and criticism for how she dressed. And I don't think it comes naturally to Hillary Clinton. But the upside is that for some female politicians, because they are not compelled to wear the same thing as every other female politician, there is a freedom in that, which can be deployed to great effect. Joyce Banda, the former president of Malawi, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, make the most of the fact that they can turn up to formal or state or political occasions wearing, you know, fantastic-looking dresses, which are both an anchor to their constituency and their country and a way of expressing that abroad. Aung San Suu Kyi, the same thing. It became a big part of her uniform that she dressed like a Burmese woman and looked like a Burmese woman. That was a huge statement to her own followers at home and a huge statement to the rest of the world, an option she would not have had she felt compelled to wear a suit. I always thought it was interesting that Nelson Mandela, even after he became president, was rarely seen in a suit and tie. He did still favour those fantastic, colourful, expressive shirts.
That was Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller. The most ubiquitous visual shorthand for a nation, to be found everywhere from diplomatic meetings to football matches, is its flag. Vexillology is a scientific study of the history, symbolism, and usage of flags. To learn more about what makes a flag fly, I sat down with Graham Bartram, chief vexillologist for the Flag Institute, the largest flag organisation in the world, based here in London.
Where a lot of people go wrong when they're designing a flag is they start off with a nice A4 piece of paper in front of them and start designing their flag. And what they forget is the actual flag is made out of fabric and will hardly ever be displayed as a nice, simple rectangle. It will be an incredibly complicated three-dimensional shape which wraps around itself and bends and twists and sometimes just hangs limply. The classic mistake: put something on the right-hand side of your design, assuming that your flagpole's on the left-hand side. That item will hardly ever be visible, because the way flags work in the real world is that the right-hand side is rarely visible.
What should a flag achieve through its design?
Well, recognition. That's the whole purpose of a flag, is to identify itself and therefore the country to which it represents, or the organisation which it represents.
But there's also the symbolic function, right? It's not just the fact that it has to be, you know, visual recognisability is probably a relatively not very important criterion by which we judge a flag, evaluate a flag against other flags. Our favourite flags tend to be ones which are visually striking, but also give a sense of the nation that they represent, no?
That's true to a certain extent, but when people talk about the meaning of flags, quite often that meaning has been added afterwards. So the French will tell you that the tricolour is fraternity, equality, égalité. The three stripes stand for the three elements of their national motto. But in fact, the three stripes stand, two of them stand for Paris and one of them stands for the king. The flag was created before anyone thought of putting those three meanings to it.
What are your favourite and least favourite flags looking around the world and why?
I suspect my favourite flag is one that actually breaks most of the design rules, which is South Africa. South Africa's flag has six colours in it. Normally you try and keep to two or three colours in a flag design. But it was a flag created for a purpose. It was a flag created as part of a nation-building exercise. And it achieved that. It actually created the nation it represents. So much so that the country is now called the Rainbow Nation, after its flag.
And what about your least favourite?
Oh, least favourite. I think if we're talking national flags, certainly the least favourite to draw is Turkmenistan, because it has the world's most complicated carpet design down the side and takes days to draw. In general terms, I'm not very fond of Bangladesh because it doesn't have very good contrast. It's got a red circle on a green background, and it's quite often a dark red circle on a dark green background. And I just think that's not really very good contrast at all.
Graham, earlier this year, New Zealand had a vote on whether or not to change their flag. And there was an open competition for entries to replace that flag. And then subsequently, a public vote on whether or not to replace the current flag with the winner of the open competition. Now, in the end, they stuck with the flag that they've always had. But what did you think of this democratic mechanism, not only of deciding whether or not to replace the flag, but also to come up with the replacement flag designs?
Well, it did mean that none of the actual replacement designs were really that strong from a design point of view. They all had problems with them. But the thing I found most interesting about the whole New Zealand operation was you were talking about how important it is that a flag represents its country. And politicians get very excited about this and say, oh, we have to update the flag because our country isn't the same as it was 50 years ago, and we need to represent that in our flag. And I think what New Zealand showed was actually the design of the flag is much less important than the fact that it's your flag. And people will fight and die for a poor design as long as it's their poor design, their national flag. So the power that a national flag has derives not from the design, but from the people who believe in it.
That was Graham Bartram, Chief Effectologist for the Flag Institute. That's it for this week's show. If it's inspired you to set up your own nation, you can get more hints and tips from Monocle's new book, How to Make a Nation, published by Gestalten and available now. My thanks to the show's editor, Alex Funnell, and to the show's researcher, Alex Tennant and Cy Villaferte. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes, and please leave us a review while you're there. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.